I want to say I appreciate your letting him finish by 10 o'clock at night, and this is another reminder. You'll have to come back. What you don't realize is that when Jim is through at night with you, he goes home and he'll probably spend another 2 or 3 hours preparing for you for the next day because of your questions. So your questions are important, but just if you take care of him, then I can share him with you more, okay? Well, I thought it would be kind of fun and interesting for you to hear how one family has integrated life and training children and ministry together. Within our own families is where we begin to minister, teaching one another to love God, teaching forgiveness by demonstrating forgiveness, dealing with anger, encouraging and building one another up. That's where our ministry begins. Colossians 4, 5, and 6 says, "Be wise in the way you act towards outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone." You know, that begins to happen at home, doesn't it? We need to treat each other with grace and learn how to answer softly. You don't wait until your family is perfect to begin to reach out to people. If you wait that long, it may never happen. Go with what you have, and you're probably better off than most people that you're going to reach out to. Your family can be your context for reaching out to people. The ambience you create within your family is a very powerful living letter to those on the outside, and it draws attention. As you've been reading and studying, perhaps last night and this morning in Deuteronomy, even the Old Testament, in the Old Testament, the family was God's instrument for preserving his message and passing it on through future generations. So how do you do that? You do it naturally. What did Deuteronomy 6 say? It says, you talk about it when you're walking. You talk about it when you're lying down, when you stand up. Probably rappelling wasn't invented back in those days. So I don't know how you do this when you're out there on Echo Rock. But whatever you do, do it naturally. Take the opportunity to teach the scriptures. Did you ever use a rubber band or tie a string around your finger? I did. What was that for? To remind us of something very important, so we don't want to forget it. I was thinking, what would we do similar to that illustration in Deuteronomy 6 today? What about some people wear these little sweatbands when they exercise, right? What if it had scripture woven into it? And what about the sweat binders you use when you exercise so that the perspiration doesn't run down into your eyes? Every time you put that on, if it had scripture interwoven in it, it would remind you of that scripture when you put it on and when you take it off, right? Well, we don't have sweatbands in the U.S. that have scriptures interwoven into it. But I thought that's kind of what that was all about back in Deuteronomy 6. So non-structured teaching is just as important as the structured teaching, and there is a need for both. One rule, absolute, important, urgent, is that we do not overdose our kids on the Bible. Jim Rayburn, the founder of Young Life, said, "It is a sin to bore your kids with the Bible." So Jim and I have bent over backwards not to do these two things. If we're going to compete with the kids on the block out there kicking the ball or flying kites and insist that they come in for Bible reading, what's going to happen? They're going to get turned off, and they're going to create a disdain for the scriptures. And if you just sit down and read the Bible straight, as his dad did very often, and it would go on and on and on, the kids will probably fall asleep on the floor. So we need to teach the kids that the Bible works, and we must live by it. I remember one of our daughters asked Grandma, when in her dying days, "Can you give us any advice, Grandma, to live by? You've lived such a great life, and you've walked with God." And Grandma said, "Obey God, and you'll make it. Life is tough, but if you obey God, things will go well, and you'll make it." Teaching the kids the scriptures is not the duty of one parent, but it is the duty of both. And the reason for that is that one confirms the other. It isn't just dad that has the authority, or that dad has an in with God, but we both do, and it's both of our responsibilities. One may do better than the other, like at our house. He does a great job. But that does not mean that I cannot also teach the word to my kids. When my first baby was 9 months old, we were over there in that little cottage at Echo Rock. One day, I just became totally overwhelmed with the responsibility for raising this child. And so I began to search for answers and wondered, am I going to raise her? Am I going to destroy her? Is she going to be unbalanced? What's going to happen to this child? So I began to search for help. And I remembered, King Solomon was the wisest man that ever lived. He wrote a lot of things that were wise. Maybe I'll find some answers there. So I went to the book of Proverbs. And I began to search for wisdom. I wrote down everything I could find about finding wisdom. And I began to pray for wisdom and plead with God for wisdom every day. And I still do. As I was reading, I would go through and note everything that I could find that indicated what I needed to incorporate in raising my children. Any principles that I would need to teach them. And some of these things, so I had my notebook, and every afternoon as I was giving my little gal the bottle, I would put the Bible on the arm of the chair and read and then write out the things that I was learning. Some of those things I would be using very shortly, and others I probably wouldn't be using for several years. Maybe when the kids were 12, 14, 16. And so later on, as they were growing up, and we have four, I would go back and look at that notebook and see if I was integrating these things that I had learned earlier into my training of my children. Bible story books are really great, but to sit down and just read the Bible straight with the kids isn't a very good method. We had two things going on. One, we had a bamboo story. Remember? The story of a rabbit, a cat, a dog, a chicken, and a monkey. Now, this was an action-packed story. And the poor chicken, he got killed, and the monkey was the key figure. So Jim was the storyteller, and we'd sit the kids on the edge of our big king-size bed, and he'd get this crazy hat that he had, and that was his thinking hat and his imagination hat. So he would just captivate the kids by telling them this story about bamboo. Well, then on other nights, he would do the same thing with the scriptures. Jim decided to narrate the scriptures from cover to cover with our children. Same scene. Put on the hat, kids would sit there, their eyes would be this big because it was so action-packed and it was something they could get a hold of. Now, how did he do that? He would review a few chapters and then he would put the Bible out of sight and just tell it. These kids got hooked on the Bible. And as they grew, we felt they needed something more. And so usually our Bible times would be centered around something that the kids were experiencing, something they were going through, so that it would be relevant to their situation. I don't know if in your household, those of you who have children, or you were all kids and probably had brothers and sisters, was there ever any sibling rivalry? We had some knockdown dragouts at our house. And just an example of how I used this was at one particular time, I remember the atmosphere around there was pretty bad. And so at lunchtime, we always had our big meal at noon. That was a Brazilian custom. And so I thought, we need to do something about these tongues. So I opened Proverbs 15:1, and I said, I think we need to memorize a verse of Scripture. And 15:1 says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. And so we talked about that. Yeah, they agreed that's true. And so we got to memorizing that verse, and then for the next few days, we would review that verse at lunchtime. And I think it took care of that particular situation. I remember when we came back here once, Michelle was 12 years old. She's our firstborn. And she had a friend, Janet, that lived about three doors down. Well, she and Janet had a bad fight. So she came home all pushed out of shape and just was so upset, and Janet wouldn't play with her anymore, et cetera, et cetera. So Michelle did three things. One, first of all, Dad said, well, let's see what the scripture says about winning back your friend. And so he opened to Romans 12:20. It says, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. And by doing this, you will pour heaping coals on his head. So Michelle plotted out three things. One, it was Janet's birthday in a day or two. I remember she bought a birthday card and she took it over to Janet to wish her happy birthday. Did that solve the problem? No. in the junior high school, they were having a newspaper drive. And Michelle had already reached her quota, and Janet hadn't. So she began to collect newspapers and took them over to help Janet get her quota. Result? Didn't work yet. Well, then Michelle went to the kitchen, and she baked some cookies. And the whole house smelled of that wonderful aroma. And she took those cookies over to Janet. That broke the camel's back. That won the friend back. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. You know, I think Michelle learned a tremendous lesson there. And she called us this last Christmas from Mountain, Maryland, and said, "Well, I'm feeding my enemies for a big Christmas dinner. Some of the people that she works with think she works too hard, and it makes them look bad." So she still learned that lesson. Teach the kids to pray in faith. I remember when our little twins were 4 years old, we lost a darling little ring out in the grass and could not find it. We searched and searched and searched and could not find it. So I said, "Well, let's ask the Lord Jesus to help us find it, because he knows where it is." And so we prayed about that little ring and asked the Lord to show us where it was, because he could see it down in that grass. And then I whispered to the Lord myself, "Lord, please be faithful to show them where that little ring is, so that they will learn that they can trust you and that you do answer prayer." So what happened? There was the ring, and he showed us where it was. So their faith begins to grow. When our son Todd was 18 years old, he was finishing his senior year in high school. And all 18-year-olds are supposed to serve in the Brazilian military. And he was born there, so that also included him. And we began to pray whether or not this was a good time for him to go into the military. And the ambience, of course, is pretty rotten. But we thought, well, maybe God will use this in his life to teach him some real personal discipline. And I thought it might be good for him to go in. And Jim wasn't so sure that this was a good timing. And so I prayed God's will would be done, but Jim prayed that Todd would be exempt and released. Okay, so you pray the way you feel you're being led. So he reported one morning for his physical, and as they were doing all the weight and height and all this, and do you have this and that and the other thing that would keep you from serving, the officer asked Todd, do you have any strong desires for serving in the military? And Todd responded, "I would really prefer to continue my studies." And so the officer responded, "Get down, get dressed, and go home." Well, that did so much for his faith that God was interested in his continuing studies at this point in his life. I think for a while our children hitchhike on the faith of the parents. We get them through a lot of situations because of our faith and because of our relationship and our prayer life with God. But then there comes a time when the kids really need to see the hand of God operating for them. So about the time they get to be 15 years old, I began to pray that God would bring someone into their lives who would really take them to heart, who would become a mentor to them, someone who would disciple our kids. Well, for Todd, a year later, after I began praying that, The first man that lived with us, a Brazilian, that came to Christ, was moving back to town. And he asked Todd, will you go with me and help me bring back my household belongings? Well, that was the beginning. And they had been, Osvaldo lived with us for 3 years when Todd was knee-high to a grasshopper. And so it was just, thank you very much. It was just really a natural situation. And Osvaldo took the initiative. And I had not said boo. I had not asked him. I had not indicated. This was on my heart. But God took care of it for us. We need to develop character in our children's lives. And for us, it seems that God really uses suffering to accomplish this. One of my biggest prayers for each one of my kids is that God would build character in their lives. And it's hard sometimes to watch them go through tough situations. And we want to help them. We want to, you know, make it easier for them. And the tendency is to kind of buffer that. But then I realize, wait a minute, maybe God is doing what I asked him to do. And he's working on their character. So all four of them have suffered really traumatic situations. And the character is there, but it's still being formed and built upon. So how does the family minister together? The family can create a tremendous ambience for your ministry. We've always had a lot of people in and out of our home. So when the kids were little, you know how kids like to bound in and bound out and get attention and be involved and everything. So we told the kids, we never shooed them away. We said, you're welcome to join us, but come in and be very quiet and don't distract. And we'd have these open studies in our living room where the university students would come in and somebody would present a topic. One of the fellows that was mature enough to handle it and knew the scriptures well enough. And so they'd sit all in the living room on the floor and discuss a topic and then open it up for discussion. And our little kids would, they'd come in and they'd sit down very quietly. And then if they get tired, they'd get up and walk out. And then they'd come back again and they'd sit down. But nobody noticed because they weren't distracting. So the result, I think, of having all these people in our home is that all of our children are hooked on people. We have a neighbor. One day I saw her out through my kitchen window, and she was standing out in her backyard, and so I thought, oh, here's an opportunity. I was busy, but I thought, I need to go out and get to know Miriam a little better. So I went out, and I dropped what I was doing, and we stood there and lamented of knee-high weeds that were growing in her backyard, and her home was fairly new, and she didn't have sod in yet. And so I went out, and I spoke with her, and we, you know, talked about this and that and the other thing. And then all of a sudden, she absolutely blew me away. She says, Marge, I don't know what it is about you people, but you radiate light and peace. I was just absolutely flabbergasted. I hardly knew what to say. And I thought, well, Miriam, thank you. And can any one of you tell me how you radiate light and peace knowingly? I can't tell you what she will see. But what I really think it is in 2 Corinthians, Second Corinthians 2:14-15, where it says, "But thanks be to God who leads us into triumphal procession in Christ, and through us spreads everywhere the fragrance of the knowledge of Him. For we are to God the aroma of Christ among those who are being saved and to those who are perishing. To the one we are the smell of death, and to the other the fragrance of life." Who is equal for such a task? So I don't have clue one what she was observing. But what I kind of think it is like, you know, maybe this morning you put on some aftershave lotion or a little bit of perfume behind your ears. How long are you aware of that fragrance on yourself? Maybe 5 minutes, huh? Maybe 15. But if you're walking down the street or get on a bus or you go into the office and somebody passes you, and you go, you almost want to follow them, don't you? Because of that wonderful fragrance that they're emanating. I think that's what it is when we emanate the fragrance of Christ. We're not aware of it, but there's something there. And to some, they want to follow us around and get close. But others are allergic to us. And so they might avoid us. So how does the family work together? Okay. One evening, I went over and I invited Miriam and Jay, our next door neighbors who happen to be Jewish. I invited them over for an evening of wine and cheese. And I went all out. I made candles all over the place and on the coffee table, all these wonderful cheeses and crackers and breads and everything. And when they came in, they could not believe it, that I had gone to such trouble to set up a beautiful evening for them. It made them feel honored and relaxed. And we invited them to read the Bible with us because that's our habit. And she sat back on her chair and she threw her leg over the edge of the chair. She says, "Me? Read the Bible?" And then she thought for a minute. She said, "You know, I could probably learn something from it." She's a psychotherapist. And I am so intimidated by this woman because she is so brilliant. But, you know, I have some things in my life that she admires. And though I understand maybe a third of her vocabulary, she likes what she sees around our home. And so we're still praying for Miriam and Jay. Well, during that evening that we spent together, our 18-year-old twins bounded in the door and gave them hugs and sat down and talked with them for maybe 30 minutes. Not only did they sit and talk, but they asked some questions. They asked for some advice about getting into the university and what courses they were going to take. And then they bounded out and went on with their friends and their life for the evening. But when Miriam and Jay suddenly, they gasped and they said, "I can't believe 18-year-olds, they came in and they sat down and they talked with us." Because most teenagers are afraid of adults, you know, afraid of being judged, or they don't have subjects to talk about or whatever. And not only that, but they asked us for advice. That's unheard of. She's a psychotherapist and she deals with a lot of problem kids. She said, you know, we don't have children yet, but someday I'd like to have children. And when I do, I want them to be just like your kids. What an honor that was for me. The family becomes your show and tell. And it's dynamic. You don't know what people are seeing, but they have to see it. So prayer is the battering ram that it's the arm of God, the mighty hand of God, to touch lives and prepare them and get them ready for what you have to offer them. We have a prayer map of our neighborhood, and we live on a cul-de-sac, and there are probably 12 houses. And at one point, I knew everybody in that cul-de-sac. We were on speaking occasions. I knew what they did. I knew if they had children or not. But Jim and I both have prayed regularly for every one of those homes and every one of those people in those homes, that we might somehow make contact with them and have an influence in their lives. One lady in our neighborhood, in fact, she happens to be Lauren Sanny's daughter, Cheryl Downing, instigated a neighborhood watch, and she asked if I would help her get it set up. And so gladly, you know, and I thought, well, let's have the first meeting at our house. That way people would come in and they'd get to see how the Petersons are, you know, what's their living room like. You know how you like to go into people's homes, don't you, and see, you know, their decorations and everything. And I thought it'd just be a kind of a neat, casual situation where they would come into the Petersons. And we had a policeman come and tell us how to get this neighborhood watch thing organized, and he promptly looked at my front door and told me how unsafe it was. I already knew that, but it's still that way. I just pray that those guardian angels are still working for us out there. And so then we do get our neighborhood together every once in a while, and it might be the 4th of July picnic out in the park. Our house, it's right on the edge of a park. And so we get to know our neighbors during these 4th of July picnics or whatever. Then we'll decide to have maybe an ice cream social. So we have it right out in the street, right in front of our house. We'll bring out little tables and chairs, and we'll tell everybody, bring your own ice cream and some toppings, and we'll share. So we're out there until, you know, maybe a couple of hours. And it gets dark and there's no light in our street, so then everybody has to go in. But that's one way that we get together and get to know our friends. Jim started jogging with the first neighbor, the only house that was there, when we moved into this neighborhood. And we figure that Jim always logs the miles he does, and we figured that it took 500 miles of jogging with Steve until he accepted the challenge of opening the Bible and reading it together. And he kind of did that because Jim was his buddy. He wasn't really interested, but he thought, well, he's a good buddy. I think I'll just do it for him. And so, how long does it take for a person to come to Christ? We figured about 900 miles of jogging. Was it worth it? It was worth every mile. Then the wife became a Christian. We are watching that family being transformed. And one day another friend was jogging with Jim and Steve, and he said, well, Steve, what was it that got your attention? You were curious about them. Did you think they were religious nuts or something? And he said, no, I really didn't, but I noticed how they cared for each other, how encouraging they were for one another, and there was no tension. And he said, I just felt that whatever the pills are the Petersons are eating, I need some desperately. And so that's why he decided, okay, I'll give it a try. So they need to get close enough to observe us and observe you in your home. So what about the kids' friends? What do you do about them? For some reason, I don't know, I just love to have kids in, and of all ages. I think when the kids were younger, I was kind of the neighborhood babysitter, because we'd have 15, 20 kids in our yard all the time, it seemed. Sometimes I wish the mothers would take care of their own, but somehow we managed to have a lot of people around. For some, the kids have said, the friends have said, I really feel good when I come to your home. I feel like I'm accepted and loved. And a lot of good conversations happen at mealtimes. And one of the kids will say, well, Dad, how is so-and-so doing? How is Mario doing? Well, that question is good bait, because then Dad will go into the story of Mario's life, how he was a communist, he was in a terrorist cell group, how he began to investigate Christianity. 4 years later, he turned his life over to Christ. He was expelled from the terrorist cell group because he thought the friends that he was with thought this buddy was a CIA agent. And so Mario was asked to just get out of the group. Well, that, you know, people's ears stand up on end when you begin to tell a story like that. And it gets their attention and their curiosity up. And so they'll begin to ask questions. And so then we use that opportunity to say, well, you know, if you're interested in investigating the Bible, Michelle and Glenn here, or Rochelle and Eduardo, or Todd, or whoever the kid is that brought the friends in, they can start reading it with you, and they know enough, they can help you along. That's kind of how we integrate our lives and family into the ministry. What about the time crunch? That's a big one for all of us, isn't it? And so what we have decided is that we need to do with our non-Christian friends what we would normally do with our families, our relatives, our Christian friends from the church. And if it's not up here, if it's not in your mind, it's not going to happen. But when you, when your heart burns for these people that are lost, you're going to make time. You might have to eliminate some excess activities. But what do? We go on ski trips with them. That's a good way to get close to one another. We rent a condo for maybe 4 or 5 days and go skiing, so we live together day in and day out. We see their uglies, they see our uglies, and we do barbecues out on our deck. One neighbor invited us to go to the fireworks with them last year, and since Jim and I were just fixing our dinner, I said, well, first of all, you all come on over and we'll do some meat on the grill, and then we'll all go to the fireworks. Well, these people are now in Bible study with us. So if it's not frontal lobe, it won't happen. My two little gals have arrived, and maybe you have some questions And you can put them on the spot if you want to.
They're getting ready to go to Brazil with the Navigators. Raquel just finished university here in Colorado Springs and is getting ready to do a year in medical technology in Denver. So, you know, the questions are yours. Anything you want to ask, feel free. Like I told you before, they're secure people, and you're not going to frighten them off by hard questions. So who wants to ask the first question? Okay, we'll repeat the questions. Yes. Wait a minute. I'm going to repeat the question. So you have your children have friends, and the background is undesirable, and they want the child to come over and stay at their house, and you're afraid of that. How do you handle that?
I think that's why we had a lot of kids at our house all the time. I'd rather have the kids around my house than to have them over at someone's house that I did not know about. But I must admit that we did have to cut off some friendships with our children. I remember, Michelle, we had to ask you to quit playing with Betty Nisi at a point in time. And Todd, we had to get Sheeta out of his life. So there are times, I think, when we do have to explain to the kids that, you know, we're responsible before God for them and that this relationship is not a good one. He says, would it be a rule that we would not allow them to go to... You can't control your kids that closely, but... When they're still grade school age. Well, you do have to control that. Yeah, you do. Sure. What do they think... What do the kids think about being prohibited going to a friend's house? How did you feel, Michelle?
Well, I think that we had a clue as to why our parents didn't want us there. And I think sometimes, and I knew that I could get in trouble hanging out with those friends. And, you know, sometimes we probably did things that we didn't want Mom and Dad to know about. And... So it wasn't really a matter of, you know, we were upset when we couldn't play with them, but we always knew why. You know, it was never something out of the blue that there was never any reason that we couldn't understand. You know, it was always something that made sense.
I agree.
With the four children, excuse me, go ahead. Okay, with the four children, did you ever have a time when they were so rebellious that you didn't want to expose them to the public? And if so, what would you do? Yeah, their attitudes were really bad. Did you ever go through that? I'm going to let Michelle answer that.
Pick on me now. I don't think it was ever... I mean, I'm sure our parents were probably embarrassed. There's a point where you stop embarrassing your parents and they start embarrassing you. So, and there's a very short period of time in between, maybe about a week. But I guess none of us really rebelled to that point. We always had questions, and sometimes, you know, sometimes I thought that the Bible was wrong, or you know, for some reason I thought I could hard press my parents for some answers, and that they might not know, and their answers might be wrong. But that never really happened. It never worked my way. And so, you know, I think probably the worst thing that we did was when we fought among each other. And, you know, when Dad and Mom would have people over, and, you know, we were just cat and dog, especially Todd and I. And I think that probably made it a little harder for them, and they probably didn't want us in public. But they always just, you know, we deal with it, you know, event by event, more or less. And, the question is, did we ever feel resentful that there were so many people around all the time? And did we ever wish that people weren't there? And I don't really remember thinking that way. I did resent a little bit that I always had to give up my bed when people came and lived with us. And which happened often. I hardly remember a time when somebody wasn't living with us. And, you know, especially as a teenager, you know, it was always, well, you know, I have to go sleep with Raquel and Rochelle, you know, or something like that. And, but I didn't really, never really resented that people were around. You know, I actually thought it was fun. And, you know, I didn't want to have, I guess now I look back and I'm glad that it was that way, because it taught us not to live just for ourselves, which is easy to do in this culture, so.
I think something that was really important was that we, Mom and Dad, were really careful to not put us on display. And with having so many people around, we didn't feel like we had to always be at our best behavior. And if we were really going through one of our life processes, we were allowed to go through that. And Mom and Dad were always really tuned in to us, and they saw where we were emotionally, and they could pull us aside, and we could just let it out and tell them how we were feeling. And it was really important for us to not be on display, where we didn't have to be the good kids so that Mom and Dad looked good.
I'd like to say something here. Get a word in edgewise with this crowd is tough. The way I operated was, I felt that the basic question is, how is the child's heart? I found that their behavior could be all over the map. But if at the bottom of things, if there is rebellion, that's the danger sign. As long as a child is not rebellious, then you're okay. And you can relax and let the behavior go berserk a little bit in one direction or another, because it's the rebellion that's going to destroy your communication with the child, and it's rebellion that will destroy the child. And so rather than pick away all the time at all the details, you know, watch the way you cut your hair, you know, what are you wearing, you know, make sure you come in at this time and all of that, if the basic down in their hearts, if they're not rebelling, then everything's okay. Okay, what if they did rebel? Who wants to take a shot at that? Yeah.
Okay. I don't think any of us really had serious rebellion problems, but within the last year, I've just been working with high school kids as part of the NAV, when the NAV ministry's out in Columbia, and I found that parents have so many different ways of dealing with them, and some want to be extremely laissez-faire, thinking that they'll work their way through it and they'll come back all right on the end. And I think the problem with that is that kids' decisions can be fatal. You know, and you can't have a 15-year-old walking in the street at 3 in the morning. And The other thing I've found from listening to these kids is that they feel that their parents don't listen to them. And, you know, their parents are unreasonable with them or for whatever reason. And talking to the parents feel like the kids never listen to them. And so probably what I'm sensing is just that there's never really been a point of connection between the parent and the kid. And I think that the kids just crave that. They really want that from their parents. And I think it's better to start early than too late, because there's probably a point where it is too late. And, you know, where it gets really painful. But.
Yeah, one of the ways we dealt with this is a child is going to rebel against something. And that's something parents can do something about, is make sure that there's not just cause for rebellion. I remember working with a guy who had counted the number of hours he'd spent in church and was angry about every one of them. And I went to his mother, and I said, "Do you realize that your son," and the son was suicidal, I said, "Do you realize that your son is really pushed out of shape over the amount of time he spent in church?" And she says, "Well, yeah, the church was small. We're a large family. We filled a pew, and we wanted to do that for the church." Bad choice. And so a child will rebel against the system, rebel against unfair, unreasonable things that come from the parents. I discovered that I could produce instant rebellion in a child by making a decision without getting the information, giving a punishment that was more than the crime deserved, not listening or being out of touch, and then coming down with some pontification of some sort. I mean, I could produce instant rebellion. And, you know, we walked that edge all the time. But I felt that I could do a lot to avoid the rebellion just by being fair. And that's something that parents, and never do anything for appearance sake. The kid will pick that up, and he'll feel like, hey, I'm being used. And that's just cause for rebellion, I think. Okay, I saw there's some, yeah, Jeff?
We have our children in a Christian school. They are sitting 7 and 9, and that's been a tremendous gift to us. But one of your dad's premises is that you need to strip away a lot of the trappings of the church and of Christianity and become real to your neighbors. And I'm wondering whether you think that our children in a Christian school will take away from
Okay, the question is, we have our children in a Christian school, and it's been a great blessing to us. One of your dad's premises is that we need to strip away some of the Christian trappings to be more accessible to unbelievers. How do you guys feel about that?
I'll give this to Raquel.
Why did you choose the school?
Well, I've had friends that went to Christian schools, and I really liked to see what they were gaining from the school. And I felt that they had really good background and the reading that they were getting. I think it depends what kind of people you're trying to reach. There are some who can tolerate, you know, your Christian background, and there are others that would be totally turned off by that. To answer your question, let me think. No, I don't think that it's a total limitation, because what's going to show is what's in their hearts. And people are going to see that, and that will appeal to them. And I also have had friends that got burned by the Christian school, and they couldn't stand Bible anymore, and went to the public schools. And I think the question here is the health of your children spiritually.
Okay, when your friends asked you what your dad did, how did you handle that?
Go ahead. I think that's why we're both going for professions.
No, just about a year ago, we went and saw a Dizzy Gillespie concert, and it was just before he died, and we had an opportunity to go up and meet him in his room, and he was sitting there blowing on his mouthpiece, and we took something to autograph, a picture of him, and said, you know, could you please autograph this for my dad? He can't be here, you know, and we'd like to send this to him. And so he says, well, where's your dad? Is he sick? I said, no, he's traveling. And he says, well, what does he do? I said, well, I said he works for a group called the Navigators, and he says, what's he navigating? And so I kind of explained to him that, you know, he was involved with people answering their spiritual questions and, you know, figuring out answers related to life and God. And says, oh, so he's a preacher. Said, no. Says, well, so he navigates the soul, huh? And he went on and he just started blowing on his handpiece and pulls his cheeks and said, people's cheeks aren't supposed to do this. And, you know, that was the end of it. But that was always a tough question to answer. And because you don't want your parents to seem idle, which they aren't by any means. You know, they're probably some of the hardest working people, you know. And yet I think if you just explain to them that there were certain questions in life and that your parents didn't want to just settle down and live, you know, and have their two-car garage with their 2.2 kids, and but they really wanted to be involved in something significant and permanent, which involved, you know, helping people sort out questions about life and God, they usually accepted that pretty well. But we always stumbled around it, you know. It was no, no. But it's true that we are going to be professionals, too.
When Michelle was in kindergarten, the teacher asked the class, to each one, to tell what their daddy did. And so it came to Michelle. She said, well, my dad writes letters. And the teacher says, well, to whom? And she said, to my grandma. Who had their hand up over here? Yes.
A lot of us men need to work very long hours, and I'm sure your dad did too. And when that happens, it's really easy to think that the job is much more important than the view on it. That thought ever come across?
A lot of us men have to work long hours, and I'm sure your dad did too. And the impression that the kids can pick up is that the job is more important than you are. Did that ever happen to you?
I think we have the perfect dad for this example, which explains why one Christmas I gave him a ball and chain. Never saw him laugh so hard. Well, with all his travels, it would take a while to get back in tune with each other. And we really wanted Dad to know about what was going on inside. And he always took the time coming back from the trip to do that. And yeah, there were times where it felt like we were just really missing out on Dad. But deep down inside, we knew that we would prefer to support his calling than to frustrate it. And we knew he always came back with such encouragement, and each trip had so much fruit that we knew that it was something worth offering, I guess. And but yeah, sometimes, you know, we've had to just really squeeze in time and say, you know, I really need to talk to you. I really need to. And I mean, I'm blessed with the greatest parents in the world, so I can.
I think that really did happen to a degree, but we didn't really feel like we were competing with other people. You know, it was usually the more bureaucratic things that we had some resentment about. You know, it was like the meetings were always on the birthdays, or, you know, there was something that was kind of hard about it. And I think Mom bent over backwards to cover for that. And, you know, we really, you know, I mean, she filled some pretty big shoes being Mom and Dad lots of times. when Dad was traveling. And it took a lot of courage for her. So I think, you know, it was probably a little harder on Mom than it was on us, because we always felt important to both of them, you know, but Mom had to do the balancing act. So
I did that until I realized that I had reached my limitations at being Mom and Dad. And I decided that I am going to be the best mom in the world for these kids. I can't do both. And so I'm just going to let God supply and take care of the fathering when Jim is gone, but I'm going to be the best mom I possibly can. And that really took a lot of pressure off of me.
Yeah, just to comment, what they're talking about here is that in 1971 I began to travel, and probably traveled 40-50% of the time since then. And so that has put the family under a crunch that most families don't have to worry about. A lot of trips would be to other parts of the world, and I'd be gone for maybe 4 weeks on a trip. And so I would come back, and as Raquel said, there would have to be a time of getting caught up. And it's not just getting the news, but I felt that it would take about 10 days with each of the children where we would talk until we came to the point where the child felt okay and I felt okay. And if there were things that had happened that had disrupted what was going on between us, we had to work our way through that. And so it's not just getting the news that's important, but it's making sure that the child knows that you know what's going on and that it's okay and that everything is okay between you. And so that was the way we balanced it out. Okay, other questions? Yes. Good question. What things in particular will you teach your children that your parents taught you?
That God is accessible. I think the bamboo stories and the Bible stories really brought it all down to earth for us, and that we have a direct line with God, and if we lose everything else, nobody can take that from us.
Well, we're thinking of having kids ourselves, and we're trying to take all the notes we can. But I think one thing is just to cultivate in them the things that are part of their nature and their character. Just help them develop that and enhance who they are and be fulfilled. I think coming to life from a point of integrity rather than a set of constructs that our parents could have passed on. I really want them to, for one, be obedient to God, but for another, be honest with God in their relationship with God. I think I would narrow it down to that.
Another thing I would add is that when we would go through struggles and ask our parents how to handle it, they would take us to the Bible instead of telling us their experience. And that way, the Bible began to gain authority in our eyes and not their experiences. Because what the Bible says is timeless, and it'll stand.
Or
The question is, having lived in Brazil and being part of our parents' ministry, and then returning to the United States, did we feel like we missed out on anything and or shortchanged by our set of experiences, or did we feel that it was a privilege? And I would say it was a privilege. And I think our perspective on this society and this culture was enhanced by our experience in Brazil. And we did feel very different when we moved back. You know, the first time I came up was 82, and the family hadn't come yet. And they came in 85. Yeah. And so they were you were 15, and I was 22. And I think I never felt like I missed out. Never ever felt like I missed out. And I just felt strange. I felt like I didn't really understand the culture. I felt people were a little bit, they made fun of me when I couldn't figure out how to use a self-service gas pump, but that was the extent of it. You know, it wasn't anything major. You know, it wasn't like my personality had been warped or such by living in another country. It was just the things that we had to adjust to were very easy to take care of.
To show how kids, there's so much that we take for granted. I remember we were coming up here in, I think, 73 to work on a project here for a couple of years. And so I was prepping the kids for the USA. And so I was giving Michelle a test, and I said, I asked her, okay, one of the questions was Dallas. What is that? Is that a state or a city? And she just kind of rolled her eyes and said, city. So she got it right just by luck. And then I said, Green Bay Packers, what's that? And she said, a company. And so just a lot of stuff you take for granted, but they just didn't know. I mean, they were really strangers to this part of the world.
Just to add to what you were asking, the difficult thing for us was finding Christian friends, kindred spirits, who were comfortable with our unchurchedness. And I felt that in Brazil, what we were constantly doing was becoming like the Gentile. And that became very natural. And moving here, it took a long time for me to figure out I need to become like the Jew in order to get to interact with the kindred spirits. And that's really been a struggle, and I admit it still is. I feel like I haven't found my water to swim in. And so that's something that we are working on right now, is to develop our own little community, what would be a church, a body, you know, for us, because we have to meet that need, definitely. We can't just be on our own.
The question is, how much involvement do we each have at a local church? You mean presently? And has there been tension with my parents' ideas, and how have we made decisions in those areas? When I first came back, I think I ended up going to a local church almost accidentally. My friends went, and so they took me along, and I just went along. And I happened to meet, you know, Glenn through another friend who went to that church, and I married him. And, you know, so I kind of ended up going to church for a while, but our friends were such that we felt that we needed to disengage from the local church, because they had absolutely no connection. They shuddered at the thought that they would ever have to live that way in order to become Christians. And there were about four people that we were involved with that were extremely secular. And so we explained to, you know, our group of friends, our pastor, what we were doing and why we were doing it. And they really supported us. You know, one couple even moved into our building to be near us so that we would have somebody around, which is really rare. You know, that was really an act of love. You know, they're really special. And it really was a great experience to have a network of friends but not have to be part of the structure, the Sunday morning structure. And the other thing was when we moved to Maryland, we were just starving spiritually. After a year, we said, you know, we throw in the towel, we're going to go to a local church. And because we had a hard time making friends there that were... Yeah. Actually, I never thought... I didn't see myself ever marrying somebody who is... I could never picture myself, you know, 50 years of Trinity Baptist. You know, that scared me to death. Yeah. Yeah, we do. And those relationships that started in that church still remain. And now we have some involvement with the church in Colombia, which is a very dynamic, very non-traditional church. And, you know, we still feel the tension. You know, we would kind of like to be out there with our friends more so than, you know, helping run these programs or whatever. But, you know, we feel like we really need those relationships too. So,
could you repeat the question for me? Okay, for a long time, I didn't tie in because I felt that not only did I have to adjust to the American culture, I had to adjust to the Christian subculture. And that was too much. When I was 19, I started participating in a college group in a church and got very involved. I started teaching a Sunday school class. I met my mentor there, a woman that really brought me along. And I felt very comfortable with the Bible studies in homes that the churches offer. And that's where I've had an opportunity to grow a lot through those. But when all my activities involved the church activities, I felt that I was losing touch with the questions that my friends were asking, my non-believing friends. And it was about a year, and I stopped in my tracks, and I realized that I needed to balance my involvement. Mm-hmm. I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. He asked, what's one thing that we did as a family that was really important that stands up to me now? Do you want to start?
I think just being involved in God's purposes, you know, just as a whole. There wasn't a specific event, you know, it was just, you know, this is the greatest thing on earth and we're doing it.
A couple things for me. As a family, we were together in this deal. It wasn't mom and dad's business. We were all involved. It was very important for me to feel like I could bring my friends home and they weren't going to get preached at, but instead they were going to see salt and light. What's very special is our meal times, because that's where we really know each other at the heart. And, you know, sometimes we'll sit down for breakfast with a box of tissues on the table and get up at 2 o'clock. And we've really connected after that. And that is very special to me.
Hey, Brennan, how you doing? What time does your class start? Raquel, you better take him. Okay, go ahead, hon. That's fine. Yeah, Brennan has to go to class, and Raquel needs to get him there. So thanks, Raquel. Okay, yes. How do I view tithing?
Okay. Well, we lived, our entire livelihood came from people who gave to us. And I think a lot of them did more than tithe. And a lot of them gave very creatively. And, like, you know, I remember when my parents were getting a house, they just pooled some money together and helped get my parents into a house. And so giving in general is very important. You know, my parents gave, and that was always a model for us too. And I've always thought that tithing was just a little bit limiting. And, you know, if we had more, I don't know, it was just more a need thing. If somebody came and said, well, we're going someplace, will you help us out? You know, sure, we have it, we'll give it. And it wasn't necessarily, you know, we never knew, like, what percentage or this or that. But, yeah, I think it's important just because, you know, it's the old thing, where your money is, your heart is where your money is, or however they say that. You know, it's we didn't necessarily tithe to a local church. It was more to individuals that we had a connection with. Okay. The first part of the question was that, you know, we're Jews, as Jews as we can get, and other times we have a heart for the Gentiles, and there can be a conflict between going to the Jews and going to the Gentiles. And the question is, how have we dealt with criticism, which often arises? I think when we left the church in Denver to go to our friends, we faced a lot of criticism. The criticism I felt was, well, once you lead them to Christ, who's going to take care of them? Who's going to baptize them and bury them or marry them? And how are you going to be sure you're obedient to God's word? Or, you know, what if you get off track? You know, heaven's another cult, you know. And I think part of criticism, handling the criticism, was just being secure in what we felt that God was leading us to do. Honestly, many times we thought, are we wrong? You know, I mean, these people are really seriously criticizing us. You know, let's go back. And we looked over all the passages in the Bible that led us to make this decision and prayed over it, and the outcome was the same. You know, this is right. And we're here for their sake, not for the church's sake. And, you know, and they would say, well, how do you know you're going to stay on track? And I think what I was sensing was that there wasn't always a real clear understanding of the power of the Holy Spirit to help us through these things. There's a lot of, a little lack of confidence in Him in that sense. And, you know, sure, we're going to make mistakes, and people will let us fail once, maybe, you know, but we're going to continue failing many times. And so I guess the deal is just being sure of what we feel led to do. And, you know, people are going to talk, you know, they criticize you in the workplace, professionally, everywhere, anyway, so.
I'd like to follow up on that. I mean, we feel a little tension as we step away from the church, the judging that we get, the criticisms. I was asked to take a position of leadership and declined, and then you're asked to volunteer for certain things, and because you're not going to be called in a particular direction. And then you get, you know, my sense is the next step is the opportunities are not given to you, and then you're excluded a bit from your Christian friends. And I think it's a great sense of reliance on God's strength. Nobody likes to be criticized whether or not the problem is. Did you experience any of that? And really, in Mark, Jim, as well, that criticism, what brought you through that?
Okay. Yeah, the question is from a slightly different angle, where because you're seeing things a little differently and you're not taking on the programs or a lot of the activities of the church because your heart is in a different place, you feel like you end up being a little distanced from fellow Christians. And, you know, how do you deal with that? I think that that is hard. And I think part of it is communicating your vision to your friends and helping them. You know, if not accept what you're doing and come along with you, help at least help them understand. And this couple that moved into the apartment with us, one time we introduced them to our friends, and they were blown out of the water. They didn't know what to say. They didn't know how to relate to them. You know, they had a really tough time being around them. But now, today, they're going to the same kind of people, and they had pulled away from the church, desperately looking for another couple to go with them and not finding anybody. And so I really do feel it's important to just try to bring somebody along and captivate them with what you feel is important. And, you know, communication, I think, is everything, is helping the church understand that your sphere is a little broader. You're just an extension of them. You're not rejecting them. Make every effort to keep peace with them, not, you know, sensing that, you know, what we're doing is at all in any way superior. You know, they meet a specific need that we could never meet. You know, in our hearts, it isn't there to meet that need. And, you know, I think just really affirming them in what they're doing, too. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
For us, being in Brazil, we faced that kind of criticism from other missionaries because nobody understood what we were doing. And so we just tried to explain, we're getting started, and we told them, you know, what we were doing. And so we were committed to our calling, and we just figured, well, just wait, and we'll show and tell, you know, that kind of thing. Later on, they came around, and they wanted us to participate in their missionary conferences and et cetera. But we did not do that until we had something to show and tell.
Yeah, I think the criticism has been indispensable for me. I've gone lived through a lot of criticism, and I think that it has done a lot for me. It's made me have to go back to the book and make sure that what I'm doing is on the pages of the Bible. And so it kept me honest. And I think it also just, you know, it humbles you to be criticized. And you go to bed at night and you think about the people that really have grave reservations about what you're doing. And so you turn to God and you ask him, well, do you have reservations about what I'm doing as well? And so it really helps to keep you on track. And I've always felt this way, that I'm not going to react to criticism, because I'm to love my brothers. And I'm not to judge my brothers or evaluate them, because they're the Lord's servants, even as I am. I'm going to stand before God, and I'm going to have to give an account. And if God is showing me some things, well, then if I am swayed by my brothers to do something that is not a part of my calling, then I'm disobeying God. So I was between a rock and a hard place. So I felt, well, my brothers have criticized me. Now, that's not going to really hurt them all that much. I don't need to clear up the criticism. They can have their grave reservations about me, and it's okay. But I don't have reservations about them. And it's okay that they disagree. I can live with the criticism, and they can live with criticizing, and we're still going to be okay as brothers, and it's still going to be okay when we stand before God. And so I'd say that I've learned to welcome criticism as a friend, and it has helped me. The question is, did you feel that there were restrictions on what you could say in the family? Did you feel the freedom just to really express yourself?
I always did feel the freedom. I knew that probably some things I would say might hurt my parents. And I think probably for that reason I might not say some things just out of love for them. But I think that was the only limitation that I imposed on myself, not that they imposed. I had to learn pretty early that profanity wasn't accepted in the family, though. You know, they, when they caught me saying a few swear words when I was about 9 or 10, I definitely remember that lesson. But that was, I got grounded for a week from my friends. And that was the first time I'd ever been grounded in my life. So, and my brother used to often get a bar of soap in his mouth. Yeah, but as far as, I think if we were to express something about the way we felt in our relationship to God, or if we were angry at God, or confused or whatever, there was always freedom for that. I can imagine that my parents would say, well, why do you feel like you want God to go to that place where you wouldn't expect to find him? Because there was probably some underlying cause. And so, I always felt that there was freedom for that kind of communication. Even though we never, it never occurred to us that way.
Okay, it's gone to break time. Let's see, one more question aside. You had your hand up? Okay, do you want to... should we break? Let's do that. Okay, let's break. And when we come back, we're going to change subjects.